It's Encounter on VOA News Now. Encounter on VOA News Now brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here's Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on VOA News Now. I'm Carol Castiel. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was on Capitol Hill last week urging members of Congress to back a landmark deal that would allow the sale of civilian nuclear technology to India. Currently, U.S. law restricts the sharing of nuclear technology with countries such as India, which have not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. For the deal to take effect, Congress must make an exception to the law for India. President Bush and Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh signed the civilian nuclear agreement last July. The deal lets India acquire technology for civilian nuclear power. In return, India would agree to split its nuclear program into civilian and military components, and it would place most of its civilian facilities under international inspection for the first time. Critics of the deal say it undercuts the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty by rewarding a country that refused to sign that treaty and pursued nuclear weapons. Advocates inside and outside the White House dismiss such criticism, saying that it would strengthen the non-proliferation regime by putting 65% of India's nuclear plants under international inspections, a share that would grow over the years. They extolled the deal as a major step toward solidifying India's new status as a U.S. strategic partner. Proponents also cite that India, with its population past 1 billion, needs a massive expansion of its civilian nuclear program to cope with escalating energy needs. Is the civilian nuclear deal in the best interest of the United States, and should Congress endorse it? For that, we turn to Walter Anderson, a former senior State Department official, currently Associate Director of the South Asia Studies Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University here in Washington, and to Paul Leventhal, founder and former president of the Washington-based Nuclear Control Institute. Both join me at the microphones at VOA headquarters in Washington. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Let me turn to you first, Walter Anderson, to get your assessment of the deal that would make an exception to U.S. law for India. Is the deal a good one, and should Congress endorse it?
My short answer is yes, it is a good deal, and the Congress should endorse it. And to repeat the way that the Secretary started her talk when she went before the Senate last week, the major thrust is strategic. And the question is, if you think the strategic gains outweigh the nonproliferation risks, and I do.
All right, let me turn to Paul Leventhal for a quick yes or no on the deal itself.
Well, I would say the deal is decidedly not a good idea, and it surely will run counter to U.S. interests by helping India expand its nuclear arsenal, likely triggering a regional arms race with China, perhaps, Pakistan, very likely. And it sends a green light to other nations we're worried about, like North Korea, Iran, to continue their bomb programs, because we will ultimately give way just as we have with India, and that could trigger arms races in the Middle East and East Asia. So proliferation is not in the U.S. interest, and even though this deal is being characterized as being good for nonproliferation, it is really exactly the opposite.
All right, let's turn now to Walter Anderson. Walter, let's address some of these concerns of the nonproliferation community and elaborate, if you will, on the benefits that you think do outweigh those risks.
Well, clearly there are risks. I'm not one of those who say that you're not dealing in uncharted territory. You are. And there is something of a leap of faith that one is taking in this case. Of all the issues I've heard, the one that strikes me as the one to be most concerned with is that it does enable India to manufacture more nuclear weapons if it wants to, because of a potential access to more fissionable material. That is a problem. I don't think that's going to happen because India has a credible minimal deterrent doctrine. I don't see them rapidly expanding the number of nuclear weapons they have as long as the security situation in their neighborhood doesn't change, and they have two nuclear neighbors, China on the one hand, Pakistan on the other. Those two neighbors have cooperated with each other on nuclear issues in the past. So I don't see a major expansion because of Indian public policy. I see nothing in the Indian public debate to indicate a significant expansion. Now, what are the advantages? It's our advantage to have a strong India, a rising India. And this is not necessarily as a move against China or allied against China, but it's to have a number of poles of power in Asia. And I think that is to our advantage that that exists. There is a security advantage we have with India as the one stable country in an area that my colleagues Zbigniew Brzezinski used to call the Arc of Crisis. And India is the one stable democracy in that area that extends from Saudi Arabia in the west over to Indonesia in the east. And the protection of vital sea lanes, including vital sea lanes that go through the Straits of Malacca and Singapore, through which 50,000 ships go every year. The Indians are already cooperating with us on safeguarding those sea lanes and with its neighbors as well. And I think that's a strategic advantage which will probably grow over time that we have with the Indians.
And on the energy front?
Actually, I don't think that's a strong an argument, to be quite frank. Only about 2.5% of India's energy needs come from nuclear. And how much will that expand in the future? I've been talking to some people at the State Department who deal with it, and the most optimistic estimates I hear over the next 10 or 15 years is maybe 7-10%. Paul, you're in a better position than I to know that. I don't think it's going to be much more, and I don't think that's the core of the argument that sometimes, I must say, that's been used as a major defense, that this will enable India to have a cleaner kind of energy to use. Yes, it will, but will it be a major expansion? No, I don't think it will be.
Let me turn to Paul Leventhal. Paul, you mentioned already some of the drawbacks to the deal. Discuss those and any benefits that you may see.
Well, I agree that the energy rationale for this really doesn't make sense. First of all, worldwide, only about 20% of fossil fuel is used to generate energy, and about 80% is used for transportation and other such applications, mostly transport. So there's not going to be a tremendous saving on fossil fuels worldwide or for India by going down the nuclear path. Frankly, what India wants out of this is the ability to produce nuclear weapons. I don't share Walter's optimism that India is basically satisfied with a minimal credible deterrent. And of course, we're encouraging India to be an offsetting factor for China. And what we might be sparking here is a new Cold War between India and China. And if, as the advocates, including Mr. Anderson, say the relations between India and China are pretty good right now, then why do anything that's going to possibly exacerbate those relations? Let me just make the point that India, in its relations with the U.S., as long as I've been monitoring this, and I had a hand in the original effort to enact the Nuclear Nonproliferation Act, it was my investigation of India's first test and the U.S. secret role of providing a critical component to make that test of 1974 possible. India has been determined to become a nuclear weapon state, and the U.S. Successfully resisted it through a sanctions-oriented regime. And now we're basically giving up, and we're giving India essentially everything it wants. And I'm frankly almost overwhelmed by the suddenness and the radicalness of the change in U.S. approach to India.
But what do you say to administration officials and other advocates who are saying, look, India did not sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, but this agreement would bring most of its civilian nuclear facilities under international inspection for the first time, and even the head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed Al-Baradei, is in favor of this agreement, saying that this is a good thing for the proliferation regime or non-proliferation regime.
The issue is not the two-thirds of the power plants that are going to be coming under IAEA safeguards. It's the one-third that won't. And what India is reserving, including a breeder reactor, and a breeder reactor is, you know, an advanced commercial nuclear power technology that is intended and designed to produce more plutonium than it consumes. And the plutonium it produces is excellent weapons-grade plutonium. So it's always been an extremely sensitive technology and one that has always been reserved for civilian applications. And India is hiving off its demonstration breeder and any future breeders that it wishes to build for military purposes. So one has to look at this agreement as a facilitator of India's nuclear weapons program, and there's no way to predict in what direction that program is going to go.
Walter Anderson, let me get you to respond.
Well, that's true. I absolutely agree. There's no way to predict, and therefore we should not predict there's going to be a lot more, to be quite frank about it. The only specific facts we have is the Indian policy debate. There is no political force in India demanding a significantly higher number of nuclear weapons. They don't exist. The present policy set by Prime Minister Vajpayee was for a credible minimal deterrent. I don't know how many there are. Some say 30, some say 40, some say 50. I don't see that increasing significantly. I know of no political factor in the military, and the India doesn't count, the military force, that's actually demanding a lot more. I want to respond to some issue that came up, though, that the NPT...
Can I finish?
Let me finish. That the NPT succeeded in somehow restraining India. It didn't. The NPT failed in preventing India and Pakistan from developing a nuclear weapon. They did so for their own strategic reasons, and that China, in the case of India, that China had a nuclear weapon and it didn't. But it didn't succeed in restraining India. Let's face it, it didn't.
The NPT didn't fail in its restraint of India and Pakistan. The United States failed. It was a matter of U.S. policy. It was a matter of U.S. policy to restrain both India and Pakistan because of the volatility of the region and the desirability of not bringing additional states into the nuclear weapons sphere. And it was a breakdown of U.S. policy, despite the Nuclear Nonproliferation Act and despite our policy toward President Zia of Pakistan. They went ahead and did it because of a lack of U.S. resolve. There are always foreign policy priorities that take precedence over nonproliferation. That is the unfortunate history of nuclear nonproliferation. Nonproliferation doesn't work because there are always the realists, those who see an immediate need to modify the long-term, basically hypothetical concerns about proliferation and thereby weaken the regime, weaken the resolve, and allow these things to happen. I wouldn't blame it on the NPT. I would blame it on U.S. nonproliferation policymaking over decades, which invariably has relegated nonproliferation to the bottom of the heap.
All right, Walter Anderson.
I work with Strobe Talbot on this issue, and I can tell you he did not relegate it to the bottom of the heap. In fact, throughout the 1990s, the functionalists, namely the people who dealt with nuclear nonproliferation issues, had a major voice in the policy towards South Asia vis-a-vis the regionalists. And if you talk to State Department people, you know that right away. There was always this kind of tussle between the regionalists and the functionalists. And at least in the 1990s, the functionalists probably had the advantage. And certainly Strobe Talbot did not sweep this under the rug in his dealings with the Indians.
You're listening to Encounter on VOA News Now. My guests are Walter Anderson, a former senior State Department official, currently Associate Director of the South Asia Studies Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University here in Washington, from whom you just heard, and Paul Leventhal, founder and former president of the Washington-based Nuclear Control Institute. Well, gentlemen, I'd like now to turn your attention to the impact this deal might have on neighboring Pakistan. Let me turn to Paul Leventhal to get your assessment of what the Pakistani reaction is. Obviously, it's a rival of India's, although they're trying to work out their differences over the disputed region of Kashmir. Could it hurt U.S. relations with Pakistan?
Well, Pakistan surely wants what India is getting and made an appeal to President Bush. President Bush said, thanks, but no thanks. We're not prepared to do that, citing Pakistan's proliferation behavior, the AQCON network and so forth. The likelihood is that Pakistan will turn to China, and China will seek to make an exception for Pakistan, just like the U.S. made an exception for India. And what they're making an exception to is a regime, so-called. Regime is perhaps the wrong word because it's not exactly stolid, but there is a set of rules out there that basically say that you do not export nuclear technology to countries that refuse to put all of their facilities, not two-thirds of their facilities, all of their facilities under safeguards. And the reason for that is obvious. If you have most facilities under safeguards and the few that are not are going to be applied to weapons making. And it doesn't take a lot to make for a large nuclear weapons program. The major nuclear weapon states recognized by the NPT have relatively small reactors producing plutonium, and most of them have frozen production of plutonium. India is going to have nuclear power plants, 1,000-megawatt reactors that produce prodigious amounts of plutonium available for weapons making. This is not an abomination. This is an atrocity. And I call it an atrocity because we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. The bathwater was sort of the bad blood, the bad feelings between India and the United States over decades because of India's nuclear policy. So we're going to say, okay, we're going to change things around. We're going to normalize relations by not letting old nuclear disputes stand in the way. But we're tossing the baby out. The baby is a non-proliferation regime. Other countries are watching. Iran is watching. North Korea is watching. Their cases are somewhat different, but they're watching. And what they see, the large picture, is that the U.S. is not going to stand up to them if they really go down the Indian path. If they just go ahead and design, build and eventually test, we're going to give way. And that makes for a very dangerous world.
All right. Of course, I need to turn to Walter Anderson for response. In addition, Walter, could you also talk about the impact this deal might have on Pakistan and Pakistan's relationship with the United States, which is also an important ally in the war on terrorism?
So let me start with the last comment that Paul had made about other countries such as North Korea and Iran looking at this and getting heart that somehow the U.S. will give in to them. I totally disagree. Countries develop nuclear weapons for their own geostrategic reasons. I have talked to my friends in the government and all sorts of it, and I said, do you find any indication that the Iranians and the North Koreans are looking at what India has done as a sign that they can do the same? And they said, absolutely not. And countries do not develop nuclear weapons because of what India is doing. They do it because of their own geostrategic reasons, North Korea and Iran. And I have seen nothing to indicate. That's one of the weakest arguments of those who are opposing this deal. There are some strong arguments. That is not one of them. On the other thing, the Pakistan-India relationship, it's curious. The Pakistanis have been remarkably restrained on what's happened, remarkably restrained. I happen to know that there is something of the debate at the highest levels in the Pakistani government. Some actually see it as a potential advantage because it creates a middle ground of states that have not signed the NPT and yet have nuclear weapons and being able to sort of work out a deal similar to this one. They hope. Their hope is that they can march behind India. I'm not sure that they can, because they do, as Paul mentioned, have to get over AQ Khan, which is a difficult thing to get over.
Of course, AQ Khan being the
nuclear
scientist
for 2 decades.
Who was sold nuclear materials
to all sorts of people.
Iran, North Korea,
among
Libya.
Others. Among others. We're not even sure his network is cleaned up yet. My guess is it probably isn't. But all said and done, you know, is this going to set off an arms race between India and Pakistan? I seriously doubt it.
What about between India and China?
Oh, I doubt that even more so. In fact, here again, I have seen the Chinese comments. In fact, I've spoken at Hopkins to some Chinese military strategists that came, and they actually thought the deal was a good thing because at least it put a large part of the Indian nuclear facilities under IAEA safeguards. You know, so no, I don't see that. The Chinese strategic problem is not to the south, but it's to the east. That's where the Chinese were focusing their efforts, not toward the south.
Gentlemen, I want now to turn your attention to ways that this deal, which many say is somewhat imperfect, that perhaps more consultation with the Congress should have taken place by the administration and so forth. But here we have a deal, and members of Congress are looking into it. We have some senators who previously mentioned some misgivings. I'm talking about Democratic Senator Joe Biden, Democratic Senator and former presidential candidate John Kerry, now saying perhaps they're inclined to support the deal. Paul Leventhal, are there any changes, amendments, short of renegotiating the deal, that could be introduced that could improve this matter?
I don't really see it. I think the deal should be rejected. And I realize that is seen as an extreme position in a world of hard reality where you always try to work out some sort of middle ground. But this one really should be rejected because it's going to cause a lot more trouble than the benefits that are perceived. And I think encouraging India to get more deeply into a civil nuclear power program, whether it happens or not, is going to have enormous costs. And this nuclear renaissance that we hear so much about is only going to last until the next major nuclear accident. And there is a one in something chance of a major nuclear accident somewhere, so the one is going to come in at some point in time. But also, my sense of it is that there is no U.S. strategic interest in encouraging India to develop more nuclear weapons. And I just don't subscribe to this notion that they have all the nuclear weapons they want now. Thank you. If they did, then they would have been pleased to put all their power reactors under safeguards, but they're not. And the reason they're not is they want to produce more fissile material for more weapons.
Well, there's a major difference here in interpretation. I think the United States is interested in helping India increase its civilian nuclear capacity, Walter Anderson, but Paul Leventhal insists that no, that what India really wants from this is to increase its military nuclear capability.
Now,
which is
of course, you know, one of the risks is that it might, but it will only do so, Paul. The real world operates in geostrategic terms. If China becomes a major problem, that is, you know, right now the Indians have no intention of expanding on the number of nuclear weapons that they have. However, they want the option to be open in case there is a problem. Every country, no leader in a democracy can cut off the options facing his country should there be a problem. And there have been historically problems with China in the past and maybe in the future. They have to take that into consideration, and the same is with Pakistan. No U.S. leader would do that, as a matter of fact. No democratic leader would do that.
Let me pose the question to you that I posed to Paul just a minute ago, which is, first of all, do you think that the agreement could have been presented better to members of Congress? Could the administration have perhaps presented it differently, and we would not be witnessing such tension?
Well, my own personal view is they should have shared the debate. In fact, it wasn't only with the Congress, but it was in the bureaucracy. It was kept a very small number of officials. You know, that has something to do with the style which this administration works. Yes, I think they probably could have improved things. They probably should have been consulting with some congressmen. Congressmen like countrymen, the one thing they hate is to be taken by surprise. And so the debate that should have taken place beforehand is taking place now, and I think it's a healthy thing.
Right. Now, be that as it may, barring people like Paul Leventhal and others in the nonproliferation community who are very concerned about this deal, and no type of amendment or change could change their mind, do you think Congress is liable to introduce changes, short, as I said, of renegotiating the deal that could improve it and make it more palatable to skeptics?
Yes, I think there's a possibility, but if it goes too far, then India won't accept it. The one thing, I had a long lunch with a person who I know is a friend of both Paul's and my, who is against the deal. His argument was one that I can buy as a possibility of something that India might accept, and that is if India and the U.S. together agree to push for a fissile fuel cutoff treaty, which would affect everyone. It wouldn't be just India, it wouldn't be just the U.S., but everyone would subscribe to that. And I think that the Indians might accept that. But I'm not sure the U.S. would.
I'd like to respond to that if I could.
Yes, there is talk about this fissile cutoff treaty.
Well, understand that the fissile cutoff treaty that is proposed is not a true fissile cutoff treaty. In fact, it is a fissile production agreement, because what it cuts off is the further production of plutonium, a highly enriched uranium, outside of safeguards. But it does not contemplate cutting off production of plutonium and highly enriched uranium under safeguards for purportedly civilian applications. The problem with that concept is that unless you cut off further production of separated plutonium and highly enriched uranium, you are feeding into the civilian sector material which can be rapidly converted to military applications. And in regions that are unstable, where neighbors view each other with suspicion, if not outright hatred, and you see this, by the way, in East Asia, where Japan is about to launch an enormous civilian plutonium production program that in no way assuages the concerns of China, Taiwan, Indonesia, the two Koreas. So the problem is that that's not enough. What you need is an understanding that since plutonium and highly rich uranium are not essential civilian fuels, they should be cut off entirely. And that's considered a very radical proposal, because it doesn't appear to have any political legs. El-Baradei himself suggested there be at least a five-year moratorium, but no one paid any attention to it. What they paid attention to was his idea of internationalizing the fuel cycle. So I see the world in a very dangerous state right now, and the India agreement exacerbates all the dangerous trends. Further production of fissile material, much of it dedicated for weapons purposes, other under safeguards, but the safeguards cannot cope really with a situation where under changing circumstances, nations will abort and proceed down the proliferation path. We have to get away from plutonium. We have to get away from highly enriched uranium. This agreement goes in exactly the opposite direction.
Whereas advocates are saying, Walter Anderson, that the strategic benefits of solidifying this relationship between the United States and India will far outweigh those concerns. Do you think that's still true?
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
Okay, and what about the consequences if the deal doesn't go through? I don't know if you can predict if it will or will not at this point. Will there be adverse consequences to the relationship?
In the short term, yes. In the long term, no. Because I think the compulsions that are driving the two countries together are there, whatever happens to the agreement. I think there will be a short-term blip, and it might even adversely affect the coalition government that's run by Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, because he is against Indian opponents of the deal. The Indian opponents will take just the reverse argument that, oh yes, you know, we're putting ourselves under American tutelage in foreign policy. We're restricting the right to produce nuclear weapons. We're restricting ourselves in a major way.
They see restrictions where Paul Leventhal sees an opening.
Yeah, it's just the reverse. You're right. The argument on the other side is that that India is putting itself in a situation where its arms are held behind it, as it were, when it comes to future strategic problems it might face, specifically with China. Whatever, I think the compulsions that are driving the two countries will continue to do so, whatever happens to the agreement, though there will be, if this goes down the tubes, there will be a short-term problem, yes.
And do you
Could I just respond to that?
Go
because
ahead.
If the relationship will not be permanently soured if the nuclear deal goes down, then why couldn't we have worked on improving and building U.S.-India relations, which were going in the same direction so well, without a nuclear agreement? Why did we need a nuclear agreement to bring about this messianic age that we're going to have with India if we didn't need it in the first place?
That's a very good question.
No, I totally agree with that. That is a good question. But what this deal tried to do was to take away the nuclear issue, which has always been a kind of souring issue between the two countries. It moved the relationship faster than it would have been otherwise. And it took what was a problem that had been in the side pocket for a long time out of it and removed it as an issue, which in fact is what the Secretary had mentioned in her talk, which is absolutely true.
All right. And the last word to you, Paul Leventhal. This relationship, or rather this deal, as Walter Anderson says, in fact does add great momentum to this important relationship. If it doesn't go through, what do you think the consequences would be?
Well, if it doesn't go through, then I think it will be better for both countries. But it will cause a blip because there will be hard feelings on both sides over it not going through. But I do believe India-U.S. relations are much better prospectively without a nuclear deal that can turn sour, could turn sour in future years and exacerbate relations between the U.S. and India. I think it's a potential irritant, and beyond being just an irritant, it could lead to some really terrible things happening in the world.
And your prediction as to what will happen to the deal?
I must confess, I've seen these agreements before. I've seen the U.S.-China agreement that took years to finalize, the U.S.-Japan agreement. These deals eventually go through. Congress does a few modifying things here and there. I'm afraid it is going to go through, and I don't think the outcome is going to be very good at all.
Well, the debate over whether Congress should implement the agreement for civilian nuclear cooperation between the United States and India is likely to continue for weeks to come. And the Voice of America will bring you the latest news and analysis as the issue unfolds. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Walter Anderson, a former senior State Department official, currently Associate Director of the South Asia Studies Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University here in Washington, and Paul Leventhal, founder and former president of the Washington-based Nuclear Control Institute. Thanks again to both of you for a lively discussion.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Bob Doty. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on VOA News Now.
Encounter on VOA News Now. Encounter on VOA News Now brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another encounter on VOA News Now.